What kind of meditations have you been inspired by?
You know, I get bored easily, I guess, or just kind of get tired of one method. So usually in like a 15-minute session, I'll cycle through several. But I'll either watch my diaphragm.
Yes.
Slides up and down. The breath coming out of my nose, over my lips.
That's an only good goodie.
Mm-hmm. I found over the last couple of days, I like to think I invented this, but I probably did not.
Let's hope you did.
I have been watching my brow and realizing that I furrow my brow almost all day.
Yeah, right.
So it's been, and especially while driving.
Sure.
So that's been my meditation over the last couple of days, is just watching my brow. And then as soon as I catch my brow being wrinkled, it immediately stops being wrinkled.
Yeah. That's nice. Yeah, I think it's pretty common that we're made of 1,000 unconscious racing habits. Yeah. So you'll have plenty of new meditations to invent, I'm sure.
I've really been meditating in earnest over the last 2 weeks.
Nice.
I've gotten into it and then fallen away from it and back to it.
That happens over the course of a lifetime.
Yeah. But I'm hoping to make it one of those habits that sticks with me.
It'll decide. You'll be the last to know. So in an ideal world, let's say your meditation, takes off. Do you have any ideas of what you hope to find?
Yeah, well, one, I want to learn to love myself.
Uh-huh.
So that I can love others appropriately.
Okay.
You know, find peace.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Right. Yeah, whatever it is. Good point.
You know, and eliminate some of the tendencies I have don't serve me. You know, selfishness,
sure.
Greed,
yeah.
Anger, fear.
Good luck with those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably unique to me.
As unique as the furrowed brow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so with your kind permission, I can maybe do a little unraveling. You know, the more innocent stages, may I refer to them as that, of our seeking and contemplative adventure, it's common that our focus or bias will be on, let's say behavioral matters like loving oneself in order to love others, ridding ourselves of unwanted or superfluous, habits, defenses, compensatory mechanisms. And the sincere hope is that as some of that unwanted or unwelcome, habits of mind or habits of behavior are, seen through or released, that we'll discover a deeper and more abiding peace. So we invariably create, and of course the culture reinforces this, the religions reinforce this, right? All these systems of thinking and being and ideal behavior reinforce the myth that we would be better off with certain things and we would be better off without certain things. And you, of course, for you, are the arbiter of, right, what's useful to you and what's not useful to you. And therefore, as one's meditation matures, you might already have some, you know, mileposts or, you know, signposts of what it's going to feel like as you make, as one makes progress. Right? Yeah. So, you know, if you look at the Judeo-Christian myth or the Buddhist myth or the Hindu myth, the Islamic, the Jain, you know, anywhere you look, you're going to often find the emphasis placed on polishing behavior.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. And I'll take the bold move to suggest that the directive to polish behavior merely reinforces the apparitional presumption of one's self. So even if we were to commit ourselves to polishing behavior, and why shouldn't we? I'm not saying we should or shouldn't do it, but the fruit of it is simply going to be a reinforcer of a, let's call it a more fundamental hypnotic field that I or you or anyone takes themselves to be.
Mm-hmm.
And within that hypnotic field finds all kinds of evidence for I'm okay, and oftentimes a lot more evidence for I'm not okay. So we think that by exercising magical tools like meditation or, you know, who we keep company with or what we read, what we eat and what we don't, what our carbon footprint is, et cetera, that we'll be able to make meaningful progress away from what's unpleasant and right towards the cultivation of what's pleasant.
That implies a preference.
Doesn't it? Yeah, it has to. So, I mean, anything you find right with yourself, whether it's only you or whether all of your friends also think you're great, is going to be a certain kind of preference. And anything you find less than right with you is also going to be a preference. And downstream of what I'm referring to is this fundamental hypnotic field. Now, if we remain under the influence of a more, let's call it fundamental, nuanced hypnotic field, then no degree of behavioral modification is going to relieve us of that existential bias, existential identity. So we will remain in a forever loop, even with arduous and successful practice of preferences and not preferences. And the notion of becoming. Yeah. So as long as we are fond of the, you know, commonly shared notion or bias of becoming, then we will continue to be a product of time and space, behavioral preferences, attempted modifications, likes and dislikes as concerns our progress or lack of progress, because there's no end to what we can find within the hypnotic field of, let's refer to it as human consciousness.
So even in religions or philosophies that understand this, I would look at Buddhism specifically. Why do they have a preference for right action, right speech? Right?
Boy, that's a great fucking question. I don't know, but we can play with it. As tradition suggests, you know, the Buddha is sitting under the Bodhi tree, duking it out with the well-appointed demon Mara, who swung every amount of seduction at the Buddha that night under the tree that Mara had in his bag of tricks. And the Buddha, by that time, we would say, was sufficiently experienced and mature in his contemplative prowess, his contemplative journey, that he was somehow able to refute the nonstop onslaughts of Mara's confounding delusion, you know, pride and fear and everything. So there was, you could say, a certain kind of equanimity at that point in the Buddha's, you know, trajectory, where whatever consciousness, Mara consciousness, had to throw at him, he was right, unperturbed. He wasn't buying. By morning, let's say, the way that he was able to finally dispel Mara's onslaught was through the gesture of touching the earth, which is, you know, an interestingly pagan kind of gesture. At the culmination of their battle, right, Mara trying to unseat him and the Buddha being unseatable, Mara finally challenges him and says, "By what right do you have to refuse me?" It's not unlike 40 days and 40 nights, right, under the desert sun. It's the same kind of cathartic, right, encounter. "By what right do you have to refuse me?" And the Buddha touches the earth. And he said, by right of being, you could say, a child of, right, Mother Earth, I refuse you. And that's what broke the spell. That gesture, at least in some, you know, loose translations, of course, there's going to be hundreds or thousands of them, right? That gesture broke the spell. And the Buddha was released to, you know, whatever we imagine enlightenment. So, long story short, upon his, you know, a profound level, unutterable level of awakening, his apparent first response was, "Fuck, no one's going to get this. There's no way to convey, right, the non-dual, right, release of what we're referring to as hypnotic bias, the hypnotic bias of consciousness, which moves moment to moment faster than we can even track it, you know, pouring us full of impressions. We feel ways about the way we think. We feel ways about the way we feel. We think ways about the way we think. We think ways about the way we feel. So we end up in this wonderful hamster loop in our own, call it mind, thinking about thinking about thinking about feeling about feeling about thinking about thinking, and we create a hypnotic reverie. Out of nowhere, create a hypnotic reverie of what you could call the world and the implications of the world and my apparent place in that hypnosis of the world, which is Mara. It's the delicious, celebratory, not to be discarded, not to be denigrated. It's the celebratory revelation of the hypnotic nature of consciousness. I mean, if you were asked to design it, you couldn't do a better job. But you see, when we find ourselves in the position of preference, like this stuff's good, this stuff's not so good, I'm making progress here, I'm not making progress here, then you can see you're under the influence of this hypnotic field. Which is great, because that's how the hypnotic field works. It's designed to do exactly that, and you and I being products of it, all is good. I mean, for the whole species, you could say. Dwelling under the influence of a perfectly viable hypnotic field coming from nowhere at all, that seems to emphasize what it is we think about what we feel and what we feel about what we think in a never-ending loop of self-reference. And within a never-ending loop of self-reference, you will find unending opportunities for preference. And the continuity of one's imaginary self under the influence of that hypnosis. It's got you. It's perfect. It's perfect. It's fucking perfect. So, back to the question, why is Buddhism so full of itself to the point where though it was birthed from an incomprehensible awakening, became the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and my bias, way too much emphasis, unneeded, unnecessary, distracting, delusional emphasis on behavior modification.
Bullshit.
But you could say the Buddha, either out of weariness or compassion, and they might be the same, said, no one's going to fucking understand this shit, so we might as well give them a banana. So I've got the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, and now if you cultivate, moral and ethical fortitude, generosity, what's referred to as compassion or equanimity, all of the paramis they're referred to in Buddhist literature, that you will be more eligible. More eligible. Not now, but later, after you cultivate, you will be more eligible to see what this actually is. And that's crap. But perhaps it takes some years of doing exactly that to see what the fruits are, to see whether it actually ameliorates your fundamental existential restlessness and existential joy, or whether it just keeps spinning you into yarns of pride. Because once you're a product of preferences and then commit yourself to a process of amelioration, and if you make a little progress, pride is present. Mm-hmm. Existential pride is present from moment to moment. The same hallucinatory capacity of whatever consciousness is or isn't to spin yarns endlessly. And no yarn has any duration, if you look at it carefully. You can't find the beginning of it, and you can't find the end of it. So any, let's call it, we'll play around with the mirage of time. You can't actually occupy any given moment because you're of a streaming nature, right? You're hallucinatory, hypnotic, hypnagogic nature, because this is just streaming in. So your eyes dart, your ears dart, your mind darts, what you say to yourself, what you think about, how you feel, whether you move or not, what you conjure, what you do, what you don't do, it's streaming. It doesn't have any duration. No moment has duration. You can't find the beginning of one. You can't find the end of one. You can't find a moment. Someone could encourage spiritually to be here now, but there is no now. All there is now, but there's no now. All there is this, oh my goodness, but not any given, right, vector, component. So it's just a fascinating, over-the-top, highly pixelated, smell-o-vision in 3D, apparitional presentation, which, by virtue of its prowess, not yours, the banality of a sense of I arises out of nowhere. Consciousness, whatever it might be, is capable of, contemplating itself. Perception, you could say, is the movement of finding objects, naming objects, using an opposable thumb and a neocortex to manipulate objects, perhaps to the point of extinction. Maybe not. So the field is so rich, it's so fecund. Is so beyond profound in its demonstration and the way that it's felt. I mean, of course we're swept away. Completely swept away. But then we find, a lot to complain about, for good measure. Whether it's my behavior, humanity's behavior, family of origin issues, financial issues, intimacy issues, parking space issues, good hair day, bad hair day, right? What's in my closet? What's not in my closet? I got ripped off. I ripped off somebody else. I got, I found some really great marijuana at a great price, and then I forgot where I put it. And within this, panorama of apparitional presentation, we have the unmitigated nerve to claim I thought, I chose, I did, I'm this, I'm that, I'm going to do this about that, that about this. Right? So you can see how a a boundless mirage, fascinating, nourishing mirage of everything and nothing at all, suggests individuation, your body, and the boundary imagination of, you know, your body, your mind, your preferences, your beliefs, your superstitions. So, absolutely, we're going to find all kinds of existential frustration. But we think that the reason I'm upset or not quite nourished is because of this reason and this reason and this reason and this reason. Whether I'm blaming someone else, blaming circumstances, or blaming myself, I can pretend, I can fool myself to think that I know why I might be suffering from this, that, or the other thing. So, oh, I see that I'm suffering from this, that, or the other thing, and then Buddhism or Hinduism or this or that intervention says, well, here's why you're suffering, here's the nature of reality, and if you would apply yourself X, Y, Z, you will, A, suffer less, or, you know, if you're really grandiose, you'll be relieved from suffering altogether someday, you know, after a good 2 week run.
Maybe the reason he suggested it is because empirically, you will suffer less. And like you said, it was out of compassion, maybe.
Yeah, quite possible.
Sure.
Well, put yourself in his or her shoes. And, you know, you had come to a revelation that was beyond comprehension. Unadorned. And, you know, you want to lend again. So, yeah, what the hell? Give me something to do. Mm-hmm. Right? Give the hominids, the naked apes, something to do.
Well, it's funny. It's I'll give my dog a bone so that he doesn't tear up the furniture.
Okay. Bingo. There you go. That's right. Mm-hmm. There's nothing particularly right or wrong with, you know, Buddhism, Buddhist teaching, the cultivation of ethical culture. A certain kind of conversation or a certain kind of discovery gets kicked into gear when you're invited to look, may I say, more intimately, more drastically, at the nature of consciousness itself. To see if it's possible to peer through Mara's resplendent demonstration. Without affliction. Without the without buying into the myth of becoming. See, one creates a very profound self-identity that, who knows, starts prior to conception. And the environment that we're brought up in, the socioeconomic situation, the color of our skin, our education, the care of the way we were raised, or the neglect of the way we were raised, right, all contribute to a really complex, unique persona, full of, you know, poetic possibilities, ecstatic possibilities, and full of severely dysfunctional compensatory behaviors. So we're a very strange mix, each of us, in our own way. Again, all of which occurs, I would argue, completely involuntarily. Mm-hmm. I mean, you take anyone's personality, how the fuck did you become you? I mean, you know, show me the blueprint. Show me the points, you know, throughout your life where you chose voluntarily to, you know, go this way or that, think this way or that, feel this way or that.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that it's always because of a previous impression that was made upon you.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Just in this thing here, that it will probably my rule that it won't.
I can see why out of that realization would develop something like Zen Buddhism.
Yes.
Where it is to completely empty yourself of all of those preferences and impressions.
Can't work. Can't work. Yeah. You're not actually, one is not actually a product of any impressions. Any impression that you find, or name, or react from, is a hypnotic suggestion. Trying to approach a holographic presentation, an unadorned holographic presentation in a piecemeal manner is impossible. Because it still appears to leave, let's call it a concentrated sense of I, identifying and selecting what's present in the field from moment to moment, and, you know, either acknowledging, cultivating, amplifying, or discarding. When the field lies in present experience, is not interested in what you find, what you think, what I think, or even how we feel. Because we're just apparitionally appearing, involuntarily, apparitionally appearing. Let's say, if we want to say according to circumstances and events or nuanced qualities or conditions that occurred prior, fine. But you could also see that what's appearing is a causal and absolutely unconditioned. That's where the Buddha started getting a little strange. That this, what we refer to as experiencing, as in present experience, is a causal and unconditioned.
I'm trying to understand that. A causal, I understand. But unconditioned, meaning unresponsive to?
Well, it appears to be perfectly responsive to itself. I mean, you could say that every moment and the way that it's felt and the way that it appears in, you know, so-called evidentiary experience is it instantaneously self-fulfilling. If no particular moment has any duration, if it has no beginning and no end, if it's acausal, and any accusation or characterization that you could make of it that would look like conditioning would only be a conditioned characterization. In other words, you can't actually say with any confidence what's true or what the conditions were that may have contributed to what you're referring to as the present condition. And by the time your, quote, mind wants to feel or say something about your present condition, that present condition is 1,000 years old. Right?
I'm sorry, are you talking about a condition as in a state?
No. Not as in a state, but in whatever it is you think you find. So let's say or I or whomever, find whatever it is we think we find. And the finding of an object or the finding of a circumstance or an experience or a sensation lasts how long?
No time at all.
Doesn't. And yet, what we refer to as the mind insists that it's found something and that it is capable of characterizing it and maybe even claiming you know, what the conditions, circumstances, origin, or implication might be. But that's all hallucination. But that's how, you know, most so-called people function, is under the influence of the hallucination of their own magical capacity to imagine circumstances and events.
So is that what you might derive from that? Would be, as soon as you feel that you've understood something, you've already failed to understand it. You know,
in one way, yeah.
Feeling you understand it is
sure
already wrong.
Yes, in one respect, but in another respect, there's no right or wrong, and what we refer to as understanding is not actually a acquisition of anything. So it's possible that what we could refer to as conditioned or partial understanding is actually occurring mirthfully within a non-dual or perfect understanding, which is not influenced by conditions, unadorned. So we have these, let's say, two qualities, profound qualities. One is the quality of Mara, the demonstration of consciousness and all of its perturbation and permutation, including the presence of, you know, Homo sapiens and their, you know, the disappointing behavior. And all of that wonder field occurs, you can say, as a companion to, or within the, you know, boundless companion, which is acausal and has no conditions. So the enlightenment, you know, is not necessarily the realization of one over the other. It's the appreciation that both are concomitantly occurring. The presentation and our presumed measure of it, whether enjoyed or not, and the unadorned, which is sees that nothing is happening. Nothing has ever happened. And they don't quarrel. A more sanguine consciousness is like, this is really fucked up and I can't find a thing. And there's no hierarchy between its unadorned nature and its perturbed, expressive nature.
It's not occurring inside us.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, it's not. You know, we think, understandably, by virtue of, you know, being a complex biological field and having five senses and, you know, narrative mind and an opposable thumb and the tools of science and philosophy and language and symbols, that we could discover remarkable things about our so-called environment as a planet, right? As a solar system, as a galaxy, right? As a large cluster of galaxies, as contrasted with even further away clusters or superclusters of galaxies, you know, and we have the conventional hubris to imagine that before the so-called Big Bang, well, we don't know what this was, but whatever it was, it had an itch and bang. So we are, you know, as a biological mechanism, downstream of a genesis event that may or may not have occurred, and after enough so-called years, and a year we measure by, you know, the Earth's right circumambulation of the sun, you know, complex life, as in our complex life, matured, expressed on this particular planet under remarkable environmental serendipity. So we can think that way and do. And a companion way to consider it is like, yeah, not that. No, that's not what this is. With confidence. Yeah, that's not what this is. So we can borrow, and I think you know, mindfulness, vipassana, nostril, brow, you know, any quality of attention is, you know, profoundly useful in that it can open up a gate to unconditioned apperception, which is this. Here it is. This is the miracle of nothing ever happened. And it's the miracle of, oh my God, so much is happening. As long as we imagine ourselves or cling to the imagination or hallucination that we are the product of something, well then we're creature-fied. As the product of something that occurred prior to now, of an intelligence other than our own, then we're the creature. And marked by the bookends of birth and death, of space and time, of like and dislike, of unending preferences. And therefore, the good sense of making behavioral adjustments where we can. And that's great.
Well, I guess you're saying what of those components or aspects do you choose to identify yourself with? And I know the words are all bound up because
that's fine. Don't hesitate to use words. No problem.
But I mean, you know, so
yeah.
As long as you identify as the product of a cause,
yeah,
and conditions,
right?
You're saying you're bookended by, you know, the life and death that such a product lives.
Yeah.
If perhaps you choose to identify with the more boundless nature of nothing, not only was there no beginning or no end, it never happened in the first place.
Yeah. Well, see, the prior one you could call identification. The
non-identification.
Yeah. The second one is, there is no identification. It's unadorned. It's unbounded. There's no identity. And as strange as it may seem, I mean, here it is. Isn't it the case? Here's whatever presence is. And if we get a break, let's say, from the intense habit of rumination, of reference and implication, of belief and superstition in time, well, this is unadorned. You're enlightened. No, that's silly. It's not like it is. It's not like you can be unenlightened or enlightened. This is what it is. It appears in the way that it appears at its pleasure. There can be identification or lapse. Identification. And those are not even necessarily mutually exclusive. Could it be that your, call it, consciousness relaxes so profoundly that in the same so-called click of a moment, you have absolute confidence in being unconditioned and no quarrel with whatever conditioning might wish to appear or assert? Neither one is your concern. Maybe that's you know, hints a little bit at you know, the Buddha's trepidation, because as long as there's, you know, the body in the world, and of course the existential malfeasance and disquietude that accompanies body in the world, having useful things to do about it are useful. As it unfolds of its own nature, and the commitments, the unconscious commitments that we've made, relax, then so does the existential disquietude relax. And of course, so does the impetus, motivation to participate in practices relax. Because you have a, you know, like Commissioner Gordon could call Batman, you know, on a very special phone, you have a direct line to your own unencumbered mansion. Not in the future, but now, here. This is your unencumbered nature. If you narrate it, there's an instant separation. Mm-hmm. If that habit to narrate, the habit to become, the habit to, you know, jump on the trolley car of time, relaxes and relaxes again, and why not once again? You tell me, what is this? From that, not just perspective, but it's a felt sense. You know, we're not just talking philosophy, lining up things to believe in and not believe in, and to agree with and disagree with. The real part of the art of, you know, contemplative discovery is a felt sense. First-hand confidence. No intermediary. No authority. Right? It has to be all yours. If it's not all yours, you're going to be, one will be influenced by all manner, right, of authority and snake oil salesmen, and promises of all kinds. So the dignified, revelatory nature is yours alone. And here it is. That intelligence, unadorned, acausal, free from the angst of becoming, is yours. Presently. It's always been that. From that, call it perspective, discovery, first-hand discovery. One might find less of a motivation to cultivate behavioral adjustments. Yeah, that quality of freedom, which is first-hand and not philosophical, is instantly nourished by its own presence. Presence discovers presence. Can't say exactly what it is. And of course, anything you might say about it is going to fail. It's going to be an unsatisfactory reference. Because the fullness of presence, unadorned, acausal, all your own, is profound beyond description, profound beyond discussion. Even though we can keep talking about it just for the fun of it.
But there's no need to name it.
We have. Rumi did a good job, right? And others. And you could say any time we point at any object, we're, in a sense, naming the ineffable, right? But resting in it, as it's firsthand, resting in it, yeah, there's no compulsion to name it. Not possible. You can kind of, you know, point at it, throw a stone in its direction. But that's the release. That's the release from the imagination of the momentum of oneself and the content of what we call my life. Because right here, wherever here is, I don't know. Now, even though we both agree, good luck with that. Nothing happened to you, ever. You can't actually find anything that happened to you before now. Memory can occur. Even somatic responses can occur, like under PTSD circumstances, or circumstances of great ecstasy, there can be a memory that's both mental, sentimental, and somatic. But when those occur, though they may appear to be referring to something that happened before, they are occurring in the present. All there is now, but there's no such thing as now. It may be a little strange, but it's not really too much of a blasphemy to say nothing happened to you or I or anyone or anything before now.
That is funny that you can say, okay, you show me the past and you can't do it. You can say, show me the future and you can't do it.
Can't do it now.
But then you can say, show me now, and then it's gone.
And you can't do it.
Yes.
You can't do it. Yeah. So in a given moment, which has no duration, so is it always refreshing or is it always evaporating? Mm-hmm. And if it's both, mm-hmm. at the same so-called time, brand new and gone, you tell me what the fuck this is. Mm-hmm. Every single, not that you can find any moment, is brand new and gone concomitantly. So that what we refer to as, you know, conditioning or reference or behavior or perspectives or cultivation is totally, total hallucination.
Yeah, it's the best explanation of nothing ever happened, nothing ever will happen.
Yes. Yeah. And here it is, ongoingly. Ongoingly, this moment never happened before, never will happen again. And by the time you even, you know, sport the simplest phrase about it, gone. Gone. So it's kind of like half cup, half empty, half full. Is this evaporating? Does one get a thrill, a spiritual thrill, right? A cathartic thrill? Out of noticing that this just keeps evaporating. And does one get the same quality of thrill or a different quality of thrill of seeing, it's brand new. We're both. We're neither. Since we tend to function through the serendipity of reference, narrative, time, space, and implication, we think it's possible to know stuff, to choose, to attract, to reject, to cultivate more pleasant, ethical, spiritual behavior or perspectives. But it's not possible. The hallucination seems to be self-fulfilling. Like you said, if the Buddha was like, they'll never get this, but there's going to be a lot of suffering, you know, why don't we do the loaves and the fishes and that's the best we can do today. Great. Not to be contrary to that, but you can also see like this is impossible. In a celebratory way, this is absolutely impossible. And you take no impressions home with you. No takeout box. The impressions don't quit. I mean, they're in subtle places of meditation. The impressions are fantastic. Subtler than, you know, beyond anything we could possibly say. We don't have language for how subtle the impression field is as the system quiets down and takes note of, let's just say, you know, this intimacy, this proximity. Oh my goodness. No way to convey what this is in referential terms through symbology. And yet art and music and science and going to the moon, and it all does, right? Everything is reflective of it, but nothing could possibly be reflective of it. What? It's nonstop celebration. Even in the midst of the most heinous suffering. true, but, you know, that kind of thing maybe you speak about more quietly with people you know well. How strange it is. So this is the liberation. Not because you or I were formerly non-liberated, or that there's something to be liberated from. It's not. Excuse me. I'm going to take it. Darling, I'm in the middle of talking, but I figured I would take your call because it could be something important. Okay, honey. Got it. Thank you. Talk to you soon. Mm-hmm. Bye. Yeah. Uh-huh. Nice. A dear Andadar just passed away. That's why I took the call. See? There we are. It's like the beauty of loss, the beauty of grief, the beauty of friendship. Who is it? Is it Mara or is it Buddha? This is too rich. It's too good. This is it. In all of its horror, in all of its glory, in all of its celebration, in all of its, you know, boredom and presumption. It's all a quality of the capacity to sense it, the capacity to be in engaged relationship with the texture of presence and presence of texture. And as the habit of narration backs off, the habit to accuse, to characterize, to display, backs off. There's no enlightenment per se. And even what we could refer to as revelation is only revelation in contrast to the conditioned mind. To itself, it's always known itself to be what it is. So there's no possibility of revelation or enlightenment.
So you're saying the same exact thing about enlightenment, is that it's not a state to be reached. It's there all the time. And there's an appreciation, there may be a degree of appreciation for it.
Yes. Yeah. The yogas, all of them, I'll just to be bold about it, all of the yogas are ways of enjoying more nuanced appreciation, first-hand encounter with what this already is. Yeah. So at a stage, behavioral, right, modification, it makes perfect sense. But it's kind of like chutes and ladders. You don't know whether you'll go down a chute or find a ladder that your perspective can shift profoundly without warning, with no on-ramp, because this is already itself. That, and there's no longer the investment made in the condition that I think I'm in and the condition that I might enjoy after I participate in one or several, right, sacred rites.
Let me ask you this. Maybe you can say something about this. It's because it's so different than what we've been talking about.
Uh-huh.
So this unadorned aspect,
yes,
reminds me of, I guess it's probably the Atma, right? If that's the unmanifest.
Uh-huh.
But a lot of these, not Buddhism, but a lot of the religious traditions have a personal God.
Yes.
Like a Christian.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
And they have a personality of the Godhead. Now, I know
yes.
that that's different than the unborn, unmanifest. But
right.
Is that also, you know, a banana?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it must be. But I mean, why is it there?
Right. Well, as a broader question, not just the notion of a personal God, you know, from Hindu or whatever culture, why the variability? Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. That's really the question. Why the variability? Mm-hmm. Why not?
Well, because there's all degrees of variability.
in any so-called direction, vector, dimension, view that you might discover appearing spontaneously in your awareness, you're going to find an infinity of variability. Mm-hmm. The five senses are infinite. Mind and emotion is infinite. Imagination is infinite. Suffering is infinite, perhaps up until physical death. So you look, one looks, you know, through religious demonstration, spiritual demonstration, cosmologies of all kinds, secular and otherwise, and you're going to find an inebriating, intoxicating feel of variability. Who's to say that, you know, if one's personal ishta, you know, is Krishna, and you worship Krishna with aplomb, that the revelation we're talking about, which is unadorned, will, right, occur to you, it's going to occur to you, you could say, by way of your affection for Krishna.
In that sense, it's like meditation. It's like, it's like anything.
Yes.
It's like anything else.
That's right.
Literally anything.
Yes. See?
Yeah.
It is. It's like anything. It's like anything and everything else. All variability, miraculous variability, being an expression of the unadorned, without being mutually exclusive. The variants are discovered, or are, you could say, narrated into being by virtue of our applying language, symbology, sentiment, implication to it, right? Once you apply the miracle of narrative prowess, symbology, to the, call it the unadorned fact of whatever is shimmering in you as you, you're going to find how many variants?
It goes going forever.
And we do.
Yeah.
Delusion is not a bad thing. Delusion is on tap. And, you know, of course, it's a bit biased to refer to it as a delusion, because it's nothing other than unadorned, inexplicable presence. There's no refusal of what we might refer to as delusion, and more enthusiastic celebration of the unadorned. Even to say it's the same is not doing it justice, right? Because it's not the same. There's only one way of saying one thing here, one non-thing here, one, not two, one. And that's the nature of presence, and the nature of presence, and even calling it presence, is a kind of personification, an objectification that can reinforce the sense of, you know, being the I subject. You know, but the inexplicable, irrefutable confidence that you find in yourself as this, done, boss, no more. You transcend with no effort, instantly, with no delay, the implication of all cosmology. You are a Brahman, to put it in their vernacular. This is Brahman, you are Brahman. Done. It could be a lot of fun, or maybe a little terrifying, or both, to wander through what we call the perturbation of our life with no agenda, taking no prisoners, building no towers of Babel from the impressions that you find, streaming impressions that you find in waking consciousness, dreaming sleep, or deep sleep. How is this possible? No. Not possible. And yet, in your face. And that, you know, quality of intelligence, some might call it, you know, hubris and egotism, if they misunderstand it. But that quality of intelligence indeed sets you free. Exactly at the end. There's no delay. Whatever you're sensing now, feeling now, thinking now, is exactly this. As we relax from the habit to parse it, to name an object, then to create either a neutral, friendly, or unfriendly relationship with the object, you're free. This occurs in the way that it has always occurred, which is a causally, unadorned, serendipitously, without implication. The suffering that occurs, in a sense, is an involuntary refusal of the actual nature. The suffering is a consequence of the projection and the imposition of what we mistake this to be. At least, may I say, psychologically. I don't want to dismiss the profound suffering by being too haughty or lofty.
I understand it can sound patronizing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. You know, in yogic lore, regardless of the, you know, its origin, let's say, and you find it strongly emphasized in, you know, Hindu dharma, Sanatan dharma, right, as the depersonalization. You are not the body. You are not the mind. And it's swell to use that kind of narrative with, you know, verve. But it's impossible to convince oneself that you're not the body and you're not the mind. Something has to well up from, call it elsewhere, which is exactly here. Which acts as a, let's say, a lubricant of a sort, a lubricant and an enzyme that relieves one of the habit of narration and the habit of implication and the habit of agenda and motive, habit of having a future or having a past. So as we learn how to call it rest, abide, chill, fuck in how about exactly here, exactly now, exactly this. And the habit to narrate This? Yeah.
Easy does it.
No big deal. No pressure, no performance anxiety. Just, yeah, okay. The narration just quiets of its own accord. Do that, enjoyment. You know, why not a certain constructive depersonalization? Not a catharsis that sends us to the hospital, if that happens too. A constructive, gradual depersonalization occurs. And that strong habit of being the mind and the body and the life and the imagination gives way, yields to unadorned presence. That's good yoga.
I think one thing that'll come from this is instead of saying, I'm going to sit down and work at meditating.
Yeah.
Say, I'm going to sit down and celebrate.
Yep.
This.
Nice. Really? Well said. That simple. Yeah. Why not celebrate this? Yeah. Nothing to change. Nothing to ruminate or cogitate upon. We don't have to be clever. Figure it out. Here it is. Oh, it's me. Okay, far out. There's a certain kind of reinforcement that occurs as the nature of attention or the nature of awareness discovers its own euphoric, ebullient nature. It likes it. So it hangs out that way with, you know, greater ease. A natural attunement, natural attentivity. Which is always a gain. Even in the midst of, you know, crazy circumstances. It's still a gain. Right? The foundation of whatever presence is never lapses. Even though we may be lost in emotion, thought, practical things to do, impractical things to do. It's all occurring right at the pleasure of. The habit to narrate is, you could say, use of calories. As the habit to narrate relaxes, then the calories come back into the system. Now they're, you could say, used or consumed as euphoric disinterest. And that euphoric disinterest is not acquired, it's discovered. It's revealed. It's already so. This is the calorie burning of narration is does it's doing its job. It's distracting. It's made of distraction. So as that caloric burning relaxes, then the incumbent, already inherent euphoria, feels. Maybe one's behavior is polished. Maybe not.
Maybe one can make other suffering less, though.
Possibly. Possibly. Yeah. The magical fruits of this being this is up to this. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And that,
well, that's another thing that the Bhagavad Gita says, which is that you're not entitled to the fruits of any of your actions.
Right.
And so,
right.
You know, to think that you're going to go out and make others suffering less.
Yes.
It's not up to you.
No. No. Yeah, so you become you become a celebratory participant in the serendipity of whatever is meant. Mm-hmm. If you are turned on, let's say, by the euphoric nature of narrative-free consciousness, you're likely going to find some vehicles, or some vehicles will find you, where you can share, explore that with companion souls like this. We discover a certain, let's say, freedom from the presumption of being in a condition. Once we find ourselves in a condition of any kind, then, you know, preference and homeostasis is going to ensue. Whether that homeostasis is, you know, biologic, chemical, emotional, right, spiritual, psychic, homeostasis will occur the instant that one finds oneself in a condition and then identifies and associates with that condition. So as one's capacity for presence deepens and relaxes, if you don't find yourself in a condition, then you're free from the impulse of homeostasis response.
It's so funny because during meditation there's these feelings of, all right, am I going to get there? Who am I there now? Oh, I got to get back there.
Yes, of course.
Although not just homeostasis, but like, you know, I've got to arrive or I'm getting back.
Yes.
And then those things are exactly what it is not.
Yes, that's right. That's right. Yep. Consciousness floods itself with dilemma and delay. And personification arises out of this magical capacity to extrude dilemma and delay, which is, one's become a product of conditions. And then there's a preference and a narration as concerns those conditions, and then there is a vector or a homeostasis impulse to redirect oneself, one's attention, one's whatever, to move from the condition you think you're in to an ideal condition that is elsewhere. And that's illusion. And it's good. Very well designed. Mm-hmm. Perfectly engineered. Mm-hmm. Where does liberation hide? Right here, in plain sight. Best place for it to hide. You could say whatever consciousness is or isn't, it loves a companion. Consciousness loves company. Who's the company? You. You see? So once you are a companion to consciousness, it may be having a good time, perhaps at your expense. So the capacity to perceive, to discern, to notice, to tweak, turn the dots, is the mirthful nature of consciousness. Consciousness has knocked on your door and said, would you like to come out to play? And you're like, well, of course. Now you're a product of conditions. So without being belligerent, here's consciousness. Knock, 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 knock. Want to play, want to play, want to play, want to play. Really, endless, right? The impression fields are endless. You know, it's like the watch salesman that has a million watches. If you don't want to buy this one, you want to buy this one. You want to buy this one, you need a watch. How about a watch? How about this one? This one's nice. It's right? It's ongoing. So the solicitation, the seduction of consciousness to come out to play is perfect. Mm-hmm. It's fucking perfect. Mm-hmm. So in our, let's say, meditation, we'll call it that, just don't answer the door. And it's not that difficult, really. It's much nearer and dearer and absolutely effortless. Here it is. So what happens is, let's say that whatever awareness might be, thankfully it's nothing special or nothing at all, instead of responding to the knock-knock of consciousness to come out to play, it resides in its potential. And here this is, pure potential. No past, no future, no present even. Consciousness can keep knocking and knocking, and let's say in early stages it can feel kind of a tug, you know, it's like a tugging relationship, a tug, and you know, or a refusal kind of thing. But as the let's just call it the, well, you already know it. So what this already is reveals itself to itself, and the relinquishment of consciousness is effortless. Here it is. And the demand that consciousness makes upon one's attention to come out to play will relax and relinquish. And the Buddha's tug of war with Mara was metaphoric of that. Consciousness comes out to play. It is seductive and alluring and confounding. Because one thinks that one is of a nature, a biological nature, a corporeal nature, a sentient nature, and you're finding this rich display. So there's reciprocity, there's engagement. Which of course is, you know, magical and fun and celebratory and terrific, even in its worst moments. But underneath it, one has the companion intelligence already present and prescient intelligence to see right through the playfulness of evocative consciousness. And then you're free. Free of its permutation. But, you know, you'll wake up and go to sleep and make love and go to work and eat good food and care for the sick and do what you do.
That reminds me of the saying, being in the world but not of the world.
Like, yes.
You can't not be in the world, but you don't have to be. Well.
Yeah.
You're there, but you're really not.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. And it does, you know, takes a little getting used to. And you could say, again, much of the yoga is not so much designed to, you know, flip the switch on your enlightenment, but in many respects, it's designed to help you cope as that switch is flipped. Mm-hmm. Right? A certain kind of foundation, like a, you know, lotus posture and, you know, a platform, an asana. You build up a certain endocrine capacity so that as the switch is flipped and a certain kind of euphoric depersonalization starts revealing itself to you, you're strident. Not thrown off. Like you said, the meditation is celebratory, not directional. That's a profound shift in how one senses one's own consciousness, whatever consciousness might be. There's nothing right with us. There's nothing wrong with us. It's possible to slip between the cracks and back off, baby steps back, just a few baby steps back from the cutting edge of hallucinatory engagement. And here we go. This is that. If one is strongly identified with their beliefs and their religion and their accomplishments, you know, and their personal philosophy, they won't hear this. They can't hear it because of the momentum and the inertia of delusional identification is so prideful and so strong that anything that we call it into question is threatening. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's what I would say is the invitation.
Well, I also have a strong affinity towards anything that has brought me further along the path.
Why not? Light a candle.
But I'm not going to kill anybody over it, you know?
Right.
I'm not going to force it down their throat.
Uh-huh, yeah.
But,
right.
Then, you know, there are tools that I really enjoy and appreciate.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, yeah, fill your life with beauty any which way you can. Why not? Which could include, you know, comparative religious studies or this meditation or that meditation or karma yoga. I mean, yes. Right? Yeah, there's no refusal. We move naturally toward, either a warm appreciation of the past or regret of the past or anger or frustration of the past of our conditioning. We look forward to the future in various ways that we do. And there's a welling up of, you know, of gratitude, of appreciation, nonstop. With profound innocence, unconditioned, unadorned consciousness is very childlike. Every gesture that occurs in experience is a benediction, is a dear friend. As this curiosity deepens and solicits us, the presence of, you know, formal or scheduled meditation may persist, and it may the meditation is ongoing. The release and the simplicity is ongoing. So it's possible to continue formal practice or even retreat practice?
Yeah, but I hope it's ongoing because it's made for nicer apparitions.
There you go. Yes, if it's pleasant and the discovery is fulfilling, then we'll go for it. Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. Some voices in the non-dual field refer to this as unknowing.
Funny, it's the opposite of everything we celebrate as it's designed.
Absolutely, yeah, that's right.
Those people be the most vulnerable?
There's so much to gossip about. Come on. Many of our regular meetings, Friday night, Sunday morning, more folks show up. There's a lot of, a lot of gossip. Just being, silly and ordinary in the midst of this. Well, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Pleasure's mine.
I think we've met before.
Have we? You look familiar to me somehow.
I've been here